So we'll start out by saying the seven-line prayer. And, well, first of all, probably I think most everybody knows, I'm Isla. And the reason that I'm here talking is that Gyatso Rinpoche has asked everyone to share whatever they know and whatever they've had a chance to learn. And so I've had a chance to do these practices. So what we're going to talk about today are the practices that we do here at Tashi Choling, the monthly practices and the 2 yearly retreats, and the fact that we often gather together and chant in Tibetan for many hours at a time. And what's that all about? What does that mean? And why are we practicing like this? And so the reason that I'm talking is because I've had a chance to do these practices for several years, and I've also had the chance to learn the ritual. And I've had the chance to work with some of the High Lamas when they gave empowerments, which is the entryway to this path. And so in all of that, I've picked up a few things and just kind of seen a few things. And I've also gotten the chance to translate for Gyatso Rinpoche when he explained his reasons why we practice in this way. And so for all of those reasons, that's why I'm speaking, and that's why I'm just sharing information here. And so we are doing these practices here at Tashi Choling because Gyatso Rinpoche established it this way. And so we'll talk a little bit about that also. So whenever we begin anything, whether it's teaching or listening or learning or studying or whatever, we always start out by praying to Guru Rinpoche or saying lineage prayers. But in our case, Guru Rinpoche is, for us, the second Buddha or the direct emanation of Buddha Shakyamuni. And so we supplicate to him to help us learn as best we can. And so Guru Rinpoche is the statue there. The tall one is Chenrezig. The one next to him is Guru Rinpoche. So that's who we're praying to when we say the seven-line prayer. So we will say it once in English and 3 times in Tibetan. In the northwest country of Oregon, born in the pollen heart of the lotus, possessing astonishingly supreme spiritual attainments, you are well known as Pema Jungne, the lotus-born. Surrounded by a retinue of many dakinis, following you, I practice. Please come forth to bestow blessings. Guru Pema Siddhi Hong. Hong Oregon Yogin Nubjan Sam Pema Kesar Dongpola Yatsen Choking Ojungne Pema Jungne She Sutra Kordu Kandro Mangpo Kor Keki Jesu Dag Juki Chingi Lamchi Sheng Su So Guru Pema Siddhi Hong Hong Oregon Yuki Nubchan Sam Pema Kesa Dompo La Yatsen Choking Ojum Nye Pema Jung Nye She Sudra Kordu Kanjo Mang Po Kor Kiki Jesu Dag Druki Chingi Lamchi Sheng Su So Guru Pema Siddhi Hong Hong Oregon Yogi Nubchan Sam Pema Gesar Dongpo La Yatsen Choking Ojum Nye Pema Jungne She Sutra Kordu Kandro Mangpo Kor Keki Jesu Dag Jumki Chingi Lamchi Sheg Su So Guru Pema Siddhi Hong. So we're here to talk about the practices that we do. We do four practices on a monthly basis, and then we do two retreats every year, and we often do more retreats than that. But and so where did these practices come from? They were established by Venerable Gyatro Rinpoche. And in fact, this whole place was envisioned, and then the students were magnetized to build the temple, the statues, and everything that's here. So it all really came out of Gyatro Rinpoche's enlightened mind. And at the same time, he began establishing the practices that we do here. So when we approach these practices or come to these practices, we always have to keep in mind this is something that Gyatro Rinpoche asked us to do. It's something that he told us to do in certain ways. He gave a lot of guidelines for how to practice here and how to practice correctly. And so none of this is random. None of this is just one person's idea. It came from Gyatro Rinpoche. And, of course, he was sent here to the West by the Dalai Lama, by His Holiness Dzogchen Rinpoche, and by the Karmapa. So we can have confidence that everything that we're doing here really comes from that stream of blessings and that stream of wisdom. And so then we start to wonder about these practices. What are they? Why do we do them the way we do them? Why do we do them in Tibetan when hardly anybody speaks Tibetan? And just kind of wondering what's going on, what are we doing? And so Gyatro Rinpoche has given a lot of teachings on this, explaining his reasons for establishing things in this particular way. And one of the things he always says is that first we have to go back and look at the historical context. We have to look at our lineage. Where does this tradition come from? Because if we understand the source of this tradition, then we understand what its result will be. So we start out by going all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, because he is the founder of all Buddhism. So it doesn't matter if you're coming into contact with Thai Buddhism or Chinese Buddhism or Japanese Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism or any kind of Buddhism. It all comes back to Buddha Shakyamuni. And so we always have to start by recalling who he was and what he did and why that was important and why we've chosen to follow that. So Shakyamuni Buddha is right there in the silken robes. And he is both, in our tradition, a deity that we relate to as a deity, and he also was a historical figure who lived and breathed and had a life story, an enlightened life story. And so we have to start by remembering that. Who was Shakyamuni Buddha, and what did he do that is so special? And so this is where I'm going to ask everybody, please, anybody who wants to, just come out with a few things about Shakyamuni Buddha, who he was, where he came from. What do we know about him?
He was Indian royalty.
He was Indian royalty. Or you could say he was Nepali royalty, actually. Somewhere in that region. So he was the son of the Shakya clan. So he was Shakya royalty. It's all a bit hazy. But I think technically, well, the grove where he was born is Lumbini. I think that's in Nepal. But so he was, yes, he was royalty. He was the son of the Shakya clan. What else? Mm-hmm. So he saw that there was suffering around outside the palace. And so he grew up in the palace. He was the son of a king. He was the first son, and there was a lot of pressure on him to become the next monarch. And actually, when he was born, there were these prophecies. What do we know about the prophecies? Anybody? Yes. So the prophecies said he would either become a great ruler and rule the world, or if he chose a spiritual life, he would become an ascetic and a great spiritual master. And so from his birth, his parents were aware of these possibilities. And of course, they wanted him to become a great ruler and uphold the name of his family. So they raised him to be a ruler, and they tried his best to protect him from having any kind of spiritual thoughts or experiences. Which means they basically kept him inside the palace, and they kept him as cushioned as possible from regular life and regular beings' experiences. They tried to keep him from seeing suffering, from seeing anything that would question, cause him to question his reality and his experiences. What else? Yes. So he lived in the palace until he was like 29. And so he had plenty of time to get married and have children. And actually, that's one of the things his parents encouraged him to do when he was a bit of a wayward teenager and he was starting to wonder about suffering and wonder about human experience and that kind of thing. The ministers said to the king, oh, well, get him married. You know, that will distract him from his spiritual pursuits. So he was married. He had a wife named Yashodhara. And since he was a prince, I think he also may have had a lot of other consorts. And she actually also was very concerned with the well-being of the people, and she engaged in a lot of humanitarian work. And she also began to question what she was doing and if she was really able to help beings, sentient beings. So he lived in the palace. He had a son, he had a wife, and he had everything perfect. And actually, when he was growing up, he was really kind of a perfect human being. He was the greatest athlete. He could throw an elephant farther than anybody else and perform all sorts of amazing athletic feats and crafts. He was a great craftsman. He could basically do everything better than anyone else. So he was a perfect human being. He had it all. He was the son of a king. He was in the perfect position to enjoy worldly happiness. And this lasted until he was about 29. And he just kept wondering what was really the state of the people, what was going on outside the palace. And so finally he snuck out of the palace. And as Susan said, he looked around in the four directions and he saw different experiences of suffering that people were having. He saw the suffering of birth, the suffering of aging, the suffering of sickness, and the suffering of death. And at that point he realized that even though he was basically a perfect example of humanity, he could still not protect himself from those sufferings and he couldn't protect other beings from those sufferings. And so then he started asking, well, if all sentient beings want happiness and if all sentient beings cannot find happiness, they can't avoid suffering, what is the key to permanent happiness? What is the truth about reality? How do we put ourselves in harmony with that truth? And so he started seeking and asking and wondering. What else?
He had a brother with me at home.
Hmm?
He had a brother who lived on
Mm-hmm. So he had a brother. So what was his karmic experience?
Well, I don't know whose lifetime it was.
Uh-huh.
In one of the texts that I was reading, the brother challenged him with being a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately cut off the head.
Mm-hmm.
And when that fell apart from the body, challenging him to show up to the back to be alive in person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, thank you. So she was saying that he had a brother with whom he had a karmic experience, and later when he was the Buddha and was teaching, his brother countered him and actually even ended up cutting off his head, and he was still able to teach even though his head was separated from his body, and he was able to be of great benefit to his brother. And so we can learn about all these details of the history, and it's really important to, and Gyatso Rinpoche has encouraged us to, because when we do this, then we start having more faith and confidence and trust in Buddha Shakyamuni as our teacher. So he began questioning and wondering if there was a state of permanent happiness or if there was a way to free beings from continual suffering. And so in order to pursue this quest, he left the palace. He left his wife and his son, and he gave up all of his possessions. He gave up being a prince, and he renounced the world because he saw that there was really no essence. There was really no true happiness in the world that could be found, true essence to the world. So he gave up all of those things. And some people wonder at this point in the story, well, it wasn't that kind of irresponsible, you know, leaving your family and leaving your children to be raised by somebody else and running off into the forest. But actually what he was doing was he knew that he could achieve a state that would benefit all beings. So he was putting the greater good before his own happiness and well-being. And he was accomplishing what would actually ultimately benefit his family. So it's not always appropriate for everyone to do what Shakyamuni did, to give up their responsibilities and run off into the forest to practice. But in his particular case, it was a perfectly suitable and responsible thing to do. Were you going to say something, Madhu, about... The stories I've heard was his cousin was the one who challenged him. But again, there are so many different stories out there that it's hard to say. I don't know. I haven't heard that, so I'm not sure. So then Buddha Shakyamuni, he renounced the world, became a renunciate or a monk, and he wandered around and he found different of the spiritual masters of the time who had achieved various states of realization and meditation. And he would go and study with a particular master, and then his realization and his meditation would surpass that master. So then he would go and find another master and study with them. And so he went through a few different masters where he received all of their teachings, he studied, and then he surpassed them. So finally, he meditated for 6 years, practicing extreme asceticism. He didn't eat or drink, and he sat out in the sun on the banks of a river and meditated in that way. And after 6 years, he realized that that was too extreme, that he needed to find a way that was more moderate. And so he kind of dragged himself towards town. He was barely alive at that point. And this young woman offered him yogurt. He drank the yogurt, and that moment his body became radiantly golden. So that's why we always see him pictured as being radiantly golden. And he went and sat under the Bodhi tree, and he made this promise to himself that he wouldn't get up until he really realized the nature of reality, the true state of reality. And so at that point, he went into deeper and deeper states of meditation, where he wrestled with his own demons, he wrestled with his own desires, and he was able to just view all of those things as they came up and continue meditating and sinking deeper into a state of meditation, which refined away all of his negativity, which accumulated vast, boundless merit until he was able to achieve the state of fully awakened Buddhahood. And so the question is, what is that state? What state did he achieve? How do we characterize that? Anybody? Yes.
Actually, going back a little bit, I asked Phil Sana about this.
Mm-hmm.
I said, wasn't actually Sujata the Buddha's guru?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Buddha himself didn't figure out the middle path. She told him that.
Mm-hmm.
She said to him, you know, like, you're basically trying to bargain.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't ever get there that way. And here's some rice curd or pudding or something, yogurt, and this will kind of rebalance your body, and after this you'll be able to have a breakthrough. But, you know, I said to the son, it wasn't to judge to actually lose his will.
Yeah.
And that's kind of skipped over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of like a
footnote. Right. That's an interesting point. Thank you. So what is the state of enlightenment? I mean, we're all trying to get there, right? So how do we define it? How do we characterize it? What kind of wisdom does the Buddha have?
Understanding that there's no
Mm-hmm. Okay. Understanding there's no inherent existence to any phenomena. Mm-hmm. The wisdom of realizing that.
Bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm. Bodhicitta. Okay. So basically you're talking about wisdom of knowing the nature of everything and compassion, or bodhicitta. So yeah, that's exactly right. So there's many, many teachings on what is the state of enlightenment, and in all different contexts in Buddhism, they describe it in all different ways. But one of the most simplest or straightforward ways to think about it is that it's the union of compassion and wisdom, that state. If compassion, true compassion, is brought to its fullest point, where it's completely equanimous for all beings, where it knows all beings and exactly what they need, that kind of compassion is inseparable from true wisdom of knowing the nature of all phenomena. And when true wisdom is brought to its fullest point, that is inseparable from compassion. So the inseparability of compassion and wisdom. So that's what Buddha Shakyamuni realized. And there are many, many other ways to describe it. For example, you can say that he had the two kinds of wisdom or omniscience, the wisdom that knows the nature of things and the wisdom that knows things as they appear. So knowing everything in its entirety as it appears in every detail and knowing the nature of all of that simultaneously, that's the kind of wisdom that the Buddha has. So when we talk about Buddhism, any kind of Buddhism, Thai or Tibetan or whatever, actually, if it's really Buddhism, then the point of those practices, whatever kind of methods you're doing, whether you're playing the bell or meditating or just staring at the wall or whatever kind of meditations are happening, the point of every one of those practices should be to develop our compassion and wisdom. And if that's what comes out of your practice, you know that you're doing a Buddhist practice and that you're doing it correctly. And if that's not what's coming out of your practice, for example, if it's just making you more negative or more upset, then you know that it's either not a correct method or that you're not applying it correctly. So that's how we can always tell, are we following Buddhism? Is this Buddhism? Is this Buddhist? When you come and see a Tibetan temple, what's really going on here? It should always come back to developing compassion and wisdom. And so that's Shakyamuni Buddha, that's our teacher. We can learn more and more details about who he was and what he did. And Gyatso Rinpoche, actually, in one of his email teachings recently, he was talking about faith, and he said what faith really is understanding our Buddha nature, or understanding Shakyamuni Buddha, his qualities. And the way we increase our faith and our trust is actually just by increasing our understanding. The more we learn about Dharma, the more we naturally trust it and have faith in it. And actually, in Buddhism, the whole word faith is a little bit tricky, because we Americans hear faith and we always assume that it's blind faith. It means just trusting in something sort of without reason or having an emotional response. And in Buddhism, that kind of faith is acknowledged, certainly, but the faith that we focus on, that we really try to cultivate, is reasoned faith, or faith of understanding. I don't know if you even call it faith. Maybe it's more like trust. Trusting in something because you know its qualities, you know the details, and you know that it won't fail you. You know that it will help you understand something greater than yourself. And that's another interesting point that we have to think about as Buddhists. When we became Buddhists, obviously we were looking for something. Somehow we had realized that just relying on our own selves and our own knowledge and our own idea of what to do wasn't working out for us. And we started looking for something bigger than ourselves, or something that would explain to us, you know, how does reality work? What's going on here? Why do bad things happen to good people? You know, all that stuff, just trying to understand what was really happening. And so we ended up with Buddhism, and we ended up learning about Shakyamuni and his story and what he did, and that meant something to us, that inspired us. And so we always have to remember that that's why we're here, basically because deep down we've made the decision that my way doesn't actually get us to the state of permanent happiness. We've already made that decision. We don't always necessarily act on it, but we've made that decision. And so when we practice, what we're trying to do is say, okay, we know my way doesn't work. We're trying to follow somebody else's way. Whose way? Shakyamuni Buddha's way. So that's just sort of in a nutshell why we're following Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's all well and good, but the next question is, therefore, why aren't we reciting his sutras, his own words of our teacher, in Pali or Sanskrit? Why are we sitting around reciting in Tibetan? That doesn't make any sense. So what do you guys think about that? Yes.
The language was invented in order to embody
They're all sacred syllables.
So Susan's saying, and this is really true, that she's heard that the Tibetan language was invented to embody spiritual meanings, and all the syllables are sacred and the words are sacred. And that's very true, but so is Sanskrit. Actually, Tibetan came from Sanskrit. So we're still stuck with the question, why aren't we reciting in Sanskrit or Pali if we're going to sit around reciting in a foreign language to begin with? Because our teacher spoke Tibetan. And that's an interesting point. So then the question becomes, well, was our teacher Buddhist? Do we know? What connects our teacher back to Shakyamuni Buddha? He has a lineage. Okay. So we can start following that lineage back, right? Our teacher had a teacher. He had a teacher. We can go back and back and back. And so what you kind of end up getting to, if you do that, is you end up with Guru Rinpoche. So what we really need to understand is, who was Guru Rinpoche and what is his importance? Because he's the one who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. He's the one who spoke these practices in Tibetan. And it's from him that all of our lineage masters come. Yes?
How did he speak Tibetan? He was born in what's now Pakistan.
Well, that's a good question. So first we need to go over who he was, and then we'll know the answer to that. So I'm going to read a lot of quotes during this afternoon, and that's because when you're just a regular person like me trying to talk about Dharma, you have to quote things to show that you're actually talking about Dharma, because otherwise it could all just be my own baloney, right? And it's also a lot safer because they say things correctly and they say things much nicer than I could say them. So, but it's good to know where your quotes come from. So what I'm going to quote right now is the history that's given in an empowerment ceremony. So the entryway to this secret mantra path that we're practicing and the entryway to all the practices that we're doing here is to receive empowerment from a teacher. And it's a way that connects you to the lineage and gives you the blessings of the lineage and of the practice. And I could go on a lot more about that, but that's not the point at this moment. But in each of those empowerment ceremonies, there's always a history that's given. And the history says, this practice came from this lama, came from this lama, and it goes back to Guru Rinpoche and even back to Shakyamuni. And so every single practice that we do, when you receive the empowerment for that practice, when you're initiated into that practice, they go back and give the historical context. So it's not just Gyatso Rinpoche that thinks it's important. It's the whole tradition that thinks it's important to go back to Guru Rinpoche, go back to Shakyamuni Buddha, show that this is an authentic practice. And the reason that's so important is because if it's an authentic practice that goes back to Shakyamuni, that means it will be a cause for enlightenment. And that's the whole point. We're trying to reach enlightenment. If it's not an authentic practice, if you can't prove that it goes back to Shakyamuni Buddha, then it's probably not going to bring about enlightenment. It's probably not going to bring that result. So we always have to be checking everything. Is this authentic? Does it go back to Shakyamuni Buddha? So anyway, so in one empowerment that Yongtong Rinpoche gave, the history gave this really nice description of things, so I'm going to be quoting from that. So it says, the Buddha himself, so that's Buddha Shakyamuni, prophesied Guru Rinpoche. In the prophecy given to Magadha, which states, after I transcend the world, the lotus-born one will come, a self-arisen, deathless Nirmanakaya, and will extensively teach the secret mantra. He will surpass me. So it's not just in that sutra, but in a lot of different sutras, the Buddha spoke of Guru Rinpoche coming. Sometimes he said, my emanation will come. Sometimes he even said, he will surpass me. So this is Shakyamuni Buddha himself telling us that Guru Rinpoche is his reincarnation, is his emanation, and even surpasses him. And so we can, since we trust Shakyamuni Buddha, we can then trust the prophecies that he gave. This lotus-born one of whom the Buddha spoke not only taught to those who were already traversing the paths or to the noble ones on the bodhisattva stages, but to human and non-human individuals, those who were difficult to tame. He was an Nirmanakaya emanation of Amitabha and Shakyamuni, arising out of compassion in order to serve beings. So Guru Rinpoche He is the emanation of all past Buddhas, the source of all future Buddhas, and the regent of all present Buddhas. His enlightened deeds transcend the mind of ordinary individuals and are difficult to express with words. But if you consider what he is most famous for, it is for the treasure tradition. Guru Rinpoche first appeared in this world in the southwest at Dhanakosha Lake, where he was born in the heart of a self-arisen lotus. So Guru Rinpoche was actually born out of a lotus instead of being born from a human being. He remained in India for 3,600 years, according to the monastic calendar. The monastic calendar is only 6 months long, so actually that would be 1,800 years, according to our calendar. When the precious teachings of the Buddha were under threat of destruction by religious extremists, by his Vajra power he conquered them, and the teachings of the Buddha rose like the sun in the sky. So Guru Rinpoche was born in this lotus, and there was one king named Indra Bodhi who was really wanting a son and had been making many aspirations for a son and trying to have a son, and it was his minister who discovered Guru Rinpoche, so he brought him home and raised him as a prince. But similar to Shakyamuni, Guru Rinpoche realized that he could not be of the best benefit to beings being there as a prince, and so he found a way to get out of that country, be exiled from the country, actually. And he spent many, many years all over India, and who knows where exactly, really. But he lived for a long time before he even went to Tibet. And he didn't just go around and teach. He didn't just go around and astound people with magical feats. He also showed us how to be a good student. He went around to many of the great Indian masters and received empowerments and received teachings, and he did practice and he accomplished the practices. For example, he went to one Indian master named Prabhahasti, and he received full ordination of a fully ordained monk. So he actually was a fully ordained monk. Also later, he received the Vajrakalaya teachings from Prabhahasti and practiced and accomplished Vajrakalaya. And he studied from many, many other great masters. There was one master who was actually a wisdom dakini who had emanated as a nun named Ananda, who was practicing secretly in a cave with a group of nuns. And he went there to receive empowerment from her because she was this realized master. But outside, he encountered one of her students, one nun who was carrying this giant pot of water. And he was asking, "Where's Ananda? I'm looking for the nun Ananda." And, of course, she was in secret retreat. No one was allowed in. And so the attendant said, "I'm sorry, I don't know who you're talking about." And she'd set down her pot of water, and so just by looking at it, Guru Rinpoche made the pot so heavy that she couldn't pick it up again. So there she is struggling to pick up this pot and get an angle on it, and so finally she realized that maybe this is a visitor that she should actually allow in. So he got to go in and receive this amazing empowerments and teachings from Ananda. And so there are many, many stories like this. We can read about all the different things that he did. But the main point is that he didn't just say, "I am the lotus-born one." He said, "I am also receiving lineage. I'm following lineage. I'm getting these teachings and practicing them." And so he's also a great example to us of what we have to do. We have to go to teachers and receive teachings and receive the lineage if we want to be practicing authentically. And so finally it came the time around in the 800s AD, that there was a Dharma king in Tibet, King Trisun Detsen. And he had invited the great abbot Shantarakshita to Tibet to spread the Dharma. And they were trying to build this great monastery named Samye in Lhasa. And they were having a terrible time because Tibet was a very, very wild place. Not only was it full of humans that were not necessarily united and not necessarily all working together, but there were many non-human forces. There were ghosts and demons and beings that lived in the sky, in the earth, in the rivers. And they didn't necessarily want the Buddhism to be established in Tibet. So they were trying to build this huge monastery, and they'd bring these giant stones, and during the day they would stack them up, and then at night when everyone was sleeping, the ghosts would come and take them down again. So they tried this for many months, and they just couldn't get the thing built. So finally, they decided to invite Guru Rinpoche, and they sent various emissaries to find him in India and make offerings and invite him to Tibet, and slowly he traveled to Tibet. And as he traveled through Nepal and into Tibet, he encountered various different spirits, local spirits who lived there, who guarded mountain passes or who lived in different valleys or in all different places in this wild land. And many of them were very negative, demons who would eat humans or who would cause trouble or cause plagues and famine or whatever, but very negative kinds of beings. And so he would go, and then he would either amaze them with his magic or he would overwhelm them with his splendor or his strength, but he would cow them and he would tame them and he would ask them to command them to teach to support the Dharma and protect the Dharma teachings and protect all that was good in the world instead of being these negative, nasty, troublemaking kinds of spirits. So he did this again and again with all different kinds of beings. And then oftentimes he would go to them and he would subdue them until they were just cowering on the ground, and they would say, okay, you know, whatever, tell us what you want us to do. And he would say, well, protect the Dharma and protect all that is good in the world. And they would say, okay, but, and he's like, give up killing people and eating them. For example, or whatever it was negative that they were doing, and they would be like, well, okay, but, you know, I'm a human eater, that's my body, I need meat, give me meat, otherwise I'm just going to starve, I can't live on grass. So then he would make a deal with them. He would say, okay, you promise to protect the Dharma, to protect all that is positive in the world, and I and all my followers will make offerings to you regularly. And so we're not going to offer you meat, but we can offer you tormas, we can offer you different substances, and through the power of mantra, reciting the mantras and the liturgies, through the power of mudra or sacred gesture, and through the power of samadhi or our meditation, these offerings that we give you will become whatever you need. So if you need flesh to eat, they will become that. If you need blood to drink, they will become that. Whatever you need, they will become. If you would like four cheese pizza, they will become that for you. Whatever you need, whatever you want. And so that's the deal that he made. So if you see in our practices, there's a protector section where we recite all of these liturgies that talk about these evil or frightening or scary beings, and that talk about giving them meat and giving them blood and crunch on the bones and all of that. That's what's going on, is we are, as Guru Rinpoche's followers, we are fulfilling the promise that he made to all these beings. So finally, he got into Tibet, he reached Lhasa. He was able to overcome the ghosts that were taking down the palace at night. And he got them instead to work with him so that whatever they built during the day would be doubled at night. And so in that way, they were able to quickly build Samya Monastery and establish Buddhism in Tibet. And, of course, they did many, many things to establish Buddhism in Tibet. And they were able to really successfully establish it in a very complete, sort of fully endowed way. They were able to just establish it in a way that sometimes they even say better than India, or sort of just like very completely and sort of perfectly. And they gathered a bunch of Tibetans and sent them to India to become trained as translators, and they invited great Indian pandits to come and help. And so this amazing sort of mecca of Buddhism was created there in Tibet by Guru Rinpoche and all the others and all of their activity. And Guru Rinpoche had 25 main disciples who he taught and who achieved realization. And if you read the stories, there were also a lot of politics and a lot of nasty things happening. You know, there were ministers who made trouble for Barotsana, one of the best translators, and he got exiled for a while because of that. There were just all kinds of crazy things going on. So it's not like it was a perfect situation or an ideal situation at all. But Guru Rinpoche and all of the teachers persevered, and it was made into this extraordinary place of Dharma. So then Guru Rinpoche starts looking to the future. So if we believe that he is a reincarnation of Buddha Shakyamuni, then he must have the same wisdom as Shakyamuni, which means omniscience, omniscient wisdom. That means he can know the past, know the present, and know the future perfectly. So then if we believe that about him, then we can understand the fact that he looked into the future and he saw that things would be really difficult for future generations. In fact, even just 200 years after he left Tibet, Buddhism was almost completely destroyed in Tibet by the King Long Dharma. I mean, imagine that. Guru Rinpoche has gone to all this trouble to set everything up. There's the 25 disciples. There's monasteries. There's just this incredible hub of Buddhism happening. And just like 200 years later, Long Dharma comes in and almost destroys Buddhism in Tibet. The monasteries, all of the official sort of sanctioned ways that Buddhism was set up, all destroyed. And it was really just kept going. The stream of blessing was not destroyed because there were hidden yogis practicing in caves, keeping this tradition going in secret. So that's just one example. But he looked to the future. He saw there would be times when there would be famine or plague or trouble, politics or all sorts of difficulties. And he also looked to the future and saw that there would be all different kinds of beings with different needs throughout the centuries. Beings who had low merit who particularly needed wealth, or beings who had very stubborn minds and particularly needed obstacles to be removed, or whatever. He could just see the personalities and the experiences of all the beings of the future. And so then the question was, I mean, he probably didn't need to ask this question, but if you think about what he was doing, the question was, well, what was he going to do? How was he going to establish Buddhism in a way that could go beyond all of those difficulties, that could be accessible even past all of those obstacles? And so this is where the treasure tradition comes into play. And so the treasure tradition was actually spoken of by Buddha Shakyamuni. He said in the Samadhi Sutra, "In the future, when I have transcended the world, all of my relics and teachings will increase. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will keep them well, recording them and placing them in sealed boxes, hiding them in stupas, rocky crags, mountains, or secreted away with gods and serpents. Later, when the Dharma has become lost and degenerated, since these have been carefully preserved, they will fulfill all wishes." So there's Buddha Shakyamuni himself prophesying the treasure tradition. And so this is exactly what Guru Rinpoche did. With the assistance of Yeshe Sogyal, he would reveal practices that would be useful for certain beings at a certain time in the future, and he would teach them to one of his 25 disciples. And not only would he teach them, but he and Yeshe Sogyal would show them, this is exactly how to sing the melodies, this is exactly how to make the tormas, this is exactly how to play the instruments for this particular practice. And so they would give it to one of the 25 disciples, and they would say, in such and such future life, you are going to reveal this as a treasure. And so that being said, then Yeshe Sogyal would write down the treasure and they would hide it. And so the question is, well, where do you hide something if you want it to be undisturbed for 800 years? Well, Guru Rinpoche and Yeshe Sogyal had that figured out. So they had all these great secret places in rocks, in like rocky crags or in lakes or in the sky. Or even sometimes they would just hide it in the mind of the disciple, and they would say, it will just appear when it's the right time. It will just arise in your mind naturally. So then throughout the centuries, these 25 disciples have been reincarnated at all different times in all different places, and they have revealed these treasures. So when a treasure is revealed, then you can think of the practice. If you think about the practice, what is the lineage of that practice? Instead of like any other practice that we would get from Shakyamuni Buddha, where you would have to trace a lineage of human beings from him to us, say, oh, this practice came from Shakyamuni, or this practice came from Guru Rinpoche, and then it passed to so-and-so, and then it passed to so-and-so, and then it passed to so-and-so, and on and on and on and on. Instead of having a long human lineage, which could easily become corrupted or broken, or maybe some of the lineage holders weren't as realized as others or something like that, you can have a very, very short lineage, which means that the blessings of that practice will be very, very swift. and sure. So, for example, you can have a treasure revealer, a modern-day treasure revealer, such as His Holiness Dudjom Rinpoche, who's up on the high throne there. So this is a great master who passed away in the 80s. He actually came here and blessed this land. And he was a treasure revealer. So he would actually reveal treasures that he had received from Guru Rinpoche. So if you look at the lineage of that, there's Dudjom Rinpoche, and he received them from Guru Rinpoche. And then some people have even received empowerment from him, some people here, or else have received empowerment from Gyatro Rinpoche or Chagdu Tulku Rinpoche or one of the other great masters who received it from Dudjom Rinpoche. So that's a very, very short lineage if we go from ourselves to Gyatro Rinpoche to Dudjom Rinpoche to Guru Rinpoche. That's a very, very short lineage of very qualified masters. And so the possibilities that the blessings of this could have been broken or weakened is very slim. Or maybe it's just obviously that they weren't. So in that way, the practices that we do here are mostly his treasures. And so for that reason, because we have this incredibly direct connection to Guru Rinpoche through that treasure tradition. The Dharma King Ratnalingpa says in his treasures, so Ratnalingpa was one of the treasure revealers who revealed different treasures. I'm going to go back. So here's some more about treasures. The treasure tradition holds special blessings for four reasons. It was sanctioned by the Buddha, as just explained. It is the pith instruction of the Vajra holder. It is the direct experience of realized practitioners, and it has authentic historical origins based on interdependent connections. The Supreme Guide Shakyamuni turned the inconceivable wheels of common and exceptional Dharma, and based on his teaching, the second Buddha, the great Orgyen, Guru Rinpoche, and other awareness holders, panditas, accomplished masters, and emanated translators from India and Tibet, propagated the Dharma through the four rivers of the Nyingma, which are the river of commentary upon the scriptures, the river of ripening empowerment, including introduction to the nature of mind, the river of pith advice based on the teacher's direct experience, and the river of hands-on instruction, which includes Dharma protectors and wrathful mantra. These four rivers together made a profound, extensive, and potent Dharma, which was taught to Guru Rinpoche's 25 disciples and others in Tibet, who received and held it without changing it. Since in the future the Dharma would decline due to being strong afflictive emotions, fractured vows and samaya, and conduct which flouts the law of cause and effect, Guru Rinpoche hid treasures in the lakes, crags, and other places. He placed them into the hands of the Dakinis, entrusted them to benevolent protectors, and he placed the wisdom seal on them to prevent the blessings from fading. Later, when karmically destined individuals revealed them, since there had been no chance for their stream of empowerment to decline, their lineage of blessings to be compromised, or their sacred advice to be perverted, they were considered to have great and exceptionally sacred blessings. The Dharma King Ratnalingpa says in his treasures, in the future when the scholars are argumentative and intellectual, and when the meditators are full of bias and sectarianism, the Dharma for the degenerate times will mainly be that of the treasures. It is profound, complete, unobscured, and vast in scope. And even a few words of its instruction will certainly liberate beings. So those are some historical points that Gyatro Rinpoche has always encouraged us to learn more about. And we can always be reading more about the stories of the great masters and the source of our tradition. And now I'm going to read a short excerpt from a teaching that Gyatro Rinpoche gave back in 2012. And this was a teaching he gave at one of the Sokhs. And first he went on for quite a long time telling some of these stories and also telling other stories. And then he began talking more about Sokh and why we do it and that kind of thing. So I'm just going to read part of that. You might ask, why is it important to know about these different places, to know about this stupa, that cave, such and such mountain? What is the point, really? I thought we were supposed to be meditating and concentrating on our own minds. Yes, that is true. That sounds really good. Let's do that. But you see that if you understand the stories behind these places, then you understand some of the qualities of the enlightened activities of the masters and what they did in these places. And you appreciate their blessings, you appreciate their power, and through this your faith naturally grows and you trust them more and more. You have to trust your masters, you have to trust your lineage. If you don't trust someone, you're never going to do what they say. We have a hard enough time trying to do what they say anyway. So if we don't trust them, we're completely hopeless. So the more we cultivate faith and devotion, the more we will trust our masters, trusting the lineage gurus, then we will try in our little way to do what they say. And one way or another, we will actually be able to make some kind of progress on the path. That is called authentic practice. That will allow us to accumulate merit and purify our obscurations, which are really our only two jobs and the only two things standing between us and enlightenment. So how do we do this? How do we accumulate merit? Well, if we're not careful, meaning we don't really understand, and we think we can make something up on our own, we might think we can accumulate merit just for ourselves, and that we can purify obscurations just to get better and better experiences. But this kind of selfishness and self-concern is actually the beginnings of the great demons, like Chairman Mao or the King Long Dharma. Self-cherishing and self-concern are really at the root and the basis of what led those beings to do the terrible things that they did. We all have the potential to become a Mao or to become a Long Dharma or to become a Rudra. We do have that potential just as we have the potential for Buddhahood. So we want to be careful and mindful that we know the right way to go about it. So how do we protect ourselves and guard against this negativity? Well, you have to remember sentient beings, you buggers. If you remember sentient beings and you always try to cultivate loving kindness and compassion, you always try to remember them when you practice, you always try to do whatever you're doing for their sake, then that will protect you. That will be your armor. That will be your guide that keeps you on the right rather than the wrong path. That will be the force, the power, the motor that gives you the power to actually accumulate merit and purify obscurations. Look at the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They're not asking you to do anything different than they have already done. They all did what? Again, go back to your biographies and read the histories. Find out what they did. They worked tirelessly, only for the sake of all beings, other beings. They left none out. They had perfect equanimity. They had loving kindness and compassion, and that is where we can start. If we start there, then we know we're starting at the proper place, upon the proper path. But if we're always mixing in our own attachment, our own aversion with our Dharma practice, then pretty soon we start to wobble, we start to waver, we start to stray from the path, and that is how we start to find the path of Rudra, the path of Mao, or the path of Long Dharma. You shouldn't think this is just being said to frighten you. Of course, in one way, if you're frightened, that's good. Maybe you will practice more fervently and have more faith and devotion. So that's fine. Go for it. Be frightened. But really, the point isn't the frightening. The point is to help you stay on the right path. You should know that it's a very real danger, that beings do find the incorrect path and practice it with great diligence and perseverance and bring about terrible results from that negativity. These days, there is a protector nobody wants to talk about, Shukden. There, I said his name. Yes, you can lock me up now. It is said that actually this protector was once a disciple of Tsongkhapa himself. I don't know if this is true or not. I just know that is what is said. But at any rate, the point is that such a being of great fortune as to be a disciple of a great being like Tsongkhapa, even such a being can end up on the wrong path. So we need to be careful to avoid such mistakes ourselves. As far as anything else to do with that protector, it's really none of our business and none of our concern. Our concern is ourselves, our own negativity. That should keep us plenty busy. So we need to accumulate merit and we need to purify that negativity. How do we purify negativity? Well, we need some method, and fortunately for us, we've been given a whole wealth of methods. We have been given, for example, confession and fulfillment and soak offering. Actually, these are the most powerful methods. They're the best way to accumulate merit and purify obscurations. That is why they were revealed. That's why the treasure revealers took the time and went to the trouble. And that's why Guru Rinpoche went to all the trouble of concealing them and preparing them for us. Of course, his activity is completely effortless, so you might say that he didn't really go to any trouble at all. But that's just you wanting to be lazy. Guru Rinpoche is not lazy like you. Don't make that mistake. So we have this method of offering soak, which is why we've gathered here today. We say that we have to offer soak, and yet the word soak itself means a gathering. When you gather or collect or bring things together, that is soak. And in fact, the words to accumulate merit is actually to gather the accumulations. It is a bringing together. You bring together, and then in this case, when you're offering soak, you offer. But even as we are engaged in this wonderful practice, this wonderful method for purifying negativity and accumulating merit, we have to remember that no matter how beautiful or elaborate the ritual might be, the purpose is really to benefit beings, benefiting all beings. That includes yourself. Don't be stingy. Don't say, just me. But don't be stingy and say, just everybody else, either. Accumulating merit for all beings means for yourself and for others. We have this idea of soak, offering soak, the Ganachakra feast. Now, for a lot of Americans, soak means that you put some cookies on a plate. But actually, the word soak has a lot of meanings beyond that. Don't leave out the cookies. It's okay. You can have the cookies. Nobody's going to take them away from you. Don't freak out. You can still offer cookies at soak, and you can still eat as many of them as you want. I'm not going to stop you. But you should know that while you're eating them, that when you look around a room, that when you look around the room, that is also tsok. The room is filled with tsok. It is filled with a gathering of practitioners, the gathering of the sangha. The substances that are gathered, they are also a tsok. They are an accumulation. The merit that is produced by that gathering and offering, that is also a tsok. It is a gathering and offering. The result of that will also be a tsok. The positive result of that will be a great accumulation of merit, a great expression of merit. So those are a few things that Rinpoche said. So as I mentioned before, the practices that we're doing are the treasures from Guru Rinpoche himself. And so just to share where one of our practices, or two of our practices, came from. Here's a quote from His Holiness Dzogchen Rinpoche's biography. To give us an idea how, so this is about the heart drop of the Dakini, or the Khandro Tuktik, which we do every month on the 25th day, or Dakini Day. And this is about how that particular practice was revealed. So this is talking about Dzogchen Rinpoche. As for how he revealed the teaching of the heart drop of the Dakini, Dzogchen Rinpoche's own words are given. So this is Dzogchen Rinpoche talking. I was 25. It was the 10th day of the waning half of the 10th month in the Earth Dragon year. Yogi Trulshik Dorje, urged by the Dakinis, arrived unexpectedly and said, "You have to write a very concise and precise Dakini sadhana right now." I had been thinking to write just such a sadhana and had considered taking some time as usual to compose it. But when he said this, the complete sadhana and its meaning arose instantly and clearly in my mind. Without moving from my cushion or changing the words as they came, I wrote them down. Although it could be regarded as mind terma, I never called it that. I handed it to him on the spot. Trulshik Dorje went to Crystal Cave at Yarlung and practiced on this heart drop of the Dakini, getting many signs of achievement and gaining great confidence in the sadhana. He repeatedly asked me to set down in writing the outer, inner, and secret instruction sections of the practice that would round out the cycle. I couldn't bear the constant disturbance to my ear, so I added many branch practices related to the original. Later, a connection to this profound teaching arose for a highly placed Lhasa government official, Honorable Tsewang Rigzin Namgyal. He asked for elaboration, so I added additional stanzas to the visualization portion of the practice to make it easier to follow. During that time period, I completed the whole body of these Dakini teachings. Connected to this heart drop of the Dakini mother practice is the father practice on the Lord of the Family, Guru Padmasambhava, called the heart drop of the lake-born Vajra. Dzogchen Rinpoche said, "For the fortunately connected students, I released the secret seal of the casket spontaneously arisen from the space of awareness." Thus, he completed the cycle of teachings called the heart drop of the lake-born Vajra. When he was 33 years old and practicing at Buddha Tsepuk Cave in Kongpo with a retinue of disciples, His Holiness got sick. One of his chief disciples, Dzogchen Yogi Trulshik Dorje, led the others in hundreds of repetitions of the heart drop of the Dakini, Ganachakra, soak, for his quick recovery. So there's soak being used in order to bring about the recovery of a great master, to help everyone purify their samaya, to help accumulate merit and create the conditions for a lama to stay. About this, His Holiness said, "During that time, early one morning, I had a dream. In my dream, a lady loudly sang this prayer." And this is followed by this prayer here, which is Yinki Bendar, our actual soak verse that we recite at every practice we do at the actual soak offering section, Yinki Bendar Rigpe Sok Drosham. So this was said to Dzogchen Rinpoche in a dream. And Dzogchen Rinpoche says, "When I woke up, I didn't forget a single word and wrote down the illusory appearances of the dream. That very day, auspiciousness came, and I completely recovered from my sickness the next day." So that's just some evidence of how this very high master was revealing these treasures, and those are the treasures that we're actually doing. So when you come to practice at the temple, you see that we're doing these practices. Do we need to take a short break? Does anybody want a break? We're good? Okay. So when you come to the temple, you see that we're doing these practices. We sit down, we chant in Tibetan, we follow the chant leader, who's usually Keith. And so you might kind of wonder, well, what's going on with all of that? Now that we have some historical context, we can sort of say, what are we doing when we practice? And so what we are doing is we're following the text of the treasure, and we're following the instructions that came from His Holiness Dzogchen Rinpoche for how to do the practice correctly. So the practices that we're doing, they are generation stage practices, which means that we're generating a deity. We're usually generating ourselves as the deity. We're often also generating the deity in front. And then we're relating to that deity. And that deity is the union of appearance and emptiness, or the union of compassion and wisdom. That deity is just a symbol for the state of enlightenment, and we are relating to that. That deity is a symbol of our Buddha nature, and we are invoking our Buddha nature and relating to our Buddha nature. In Vajrayana, they say that what you are doing, the reason that Vajrayana practices are different from Sutrayana practices is that in Vajrayana, we are taking the result as the path. So we are taking the resultant state, which is that actually we all are Buddhas. We have the Buddha nature. In fact, we are Buddhas. And we are taking that as the path. So in our practices, we just go straight to seeing ourselves as Buddhas and seeing the world as if we were a Buddha. And so that's the kind of practice that we're doing. And these practices have many, many different sections, and offering and praise and visualizing and invoking and just many, many sections. And when you first see them, it's very, very confusing. In fact, when you first come to practice, really the main thing is just trying to make sure you're on the right page through the whole practice. And that's your practice. And that's the great thing about these practices and these gatherings, is that everybody has an authentic practice. No matter who you are, no matter how little you know, if you come and participate as well as you can, you're doing an authentic practice. You're connecting to Guru Rinpoche's blessings. You're purifying obscurations. You're accumulating merit. So if you're able to come and follow along in the book and you only get like really lost three times, that's great. That's a great accomplishment. If you're able to come and follow along in the book and occasionally bring to mind Dharma type themes, like, oh, I'm doing this practice because these are the words of Guru Rinpoche and I'm reciting his words with faith and devotion as his disciple. Or, oh, I'm doing this practice for the sake of all sentient beings. That's great. That's an authentic way to come and do group practice. If you're coming and doing group practice and you have an idea what the main visualization is because you read that part of the text, and you're trying really hard to think of that, or even you're just trying hard to think of your face as the Buddha's face, or if you're trying hard to just say, okay, all forms are the deity, all thoughts are the deity's wisdom, all sounds are mantra, and you're just trying to remember that, that's an authentic practice. If you come and you understand every single section of the generation stage and what's going on, and you visualize perfectly, and you know, you're able to just do the practice completely and abide in pure view, of course that's a perfect practice too. So there's all different levels of perfect practice, and everyone is capable of doing a perfect practice. There's nobody who's incapable, because the way you do perfect practice is you just try. Basically, that's really all that's required on the Buddhist path. If you're trying, the Buddhas are there to help you. They always say that the gurus have this hook of compassion, but they need the ring of the student's faith in order to connect and in order to be able to pull you along on the path to enlightenment. So there's all these Buddhas all the time trying to hook sentient beings. They've got their hooks out and they're trying and trying and trying. You know, and most of the time, sentient beings, we have absolutely no faith. We're not trying. We have no interest in Dharma. We're just completely shut off. We're in our own little safe zone. You know, we think that we're in our safe zone. We think that we are in our comfort zone, in our little bubble of my way. And we're very safe. We're safe from the Buddha's blessings. We're safe from ever getting enlightened. And that's how all sentient beings are most of the time. And that's why samsara is there. We're slippery. We're these slippery little guys. And the Buddhas keep trying to hook us and trying to pull us along. It's very difficult because there's no way to get a grip. So when we extend faith or trust or interest, or we try even a little bit, the Buddhas are right there. They're so excited. They're like, finally, something I can get a hold of here. And so they will respond and they will help us. So all you have to do in these practices is try. You just reach out. You just show up. You try to follow in the book. You try to learn something about the practice each time. You try to do a little something. You know, you try to help out. Try to help out with setting up soak. Try to help with keeping the temple clean. Just trying as much as we can. And that's really how to have a perfect practice every time. Does anybody have any thoughts or questions so far? Huh? Yeah. Sometimes for me, you know, occasionally I'm just in such a state when I come to practice, I'm stressed out and I'm distracted and I'm worried about something, that I'm just lucky that I sat there for 2 hours without like running screaming from the room. I'm like, that was a really big accomplishment. You know? Other times I can do a lot more. I can think, I can relate, I can, you know, but it's all about, as they say, start where you are. You know, even though we're trying to do this complicated thing, you have to be honest about, okay, now I'm just totally lost, you know, or whatever. And then just go from there and just try something. And Gyatso Rinpoche always says we have to be our own teacher, which means we have to apply the Dharma to ourselves. We're the ones who have to do that work. And we can actually do that in each moment of our lives. We can be practicing Dharma and applying Dharma. It doesn't matter if you're waking up in the morning. You can be getting up out of, you know, the bed of your delusions, standing up into an enlightened state. Or if you're opening the door, you can be opening the door to liberation for all beings. Or, you know, you can make each part of your day into a Dharma practice and give it Dharma meaning if you try. Or you can just go along having things be ordinary and depressing, basically. So we always have the choice. And so it's the same with coming to practice at the temple. Now, so what we're doing here is we are chanting. So the reason that we're chanting in Tibetan is because, not because Tibetan culture is special and amazing and we should all become Tibetans and we should all start wearing chubas and we should eat sampa and we should live in yak hair tents and like that. That's not the reason. A lot of that stuff is Tibetan culture, just like any place has a culture. And of course, all cultures have good elements and bad elements and elements that really just relate to the situation. So what we're really doing as Tibetan Buddhists is we're trying to distinguish what is Tibetan culture and what is our tradition from Guru Rinpoche. And the tradition from Guru Rinpoche, we definitely need to uphold. The Tibetan culture, of course, everybody can choose whatever culture they want to follow. If you like Tibetan clothing or Tibetan food or whatever, that's fine, no problem. But the real question is, what is the actual tradition? And so Gyatso Rinpoche, as he has taught, Tibetan tradition includes, you know, what did Guru Rinpoche teach his disciples? He gave them the words of this practice. So those words are his words. Those words carry his blessing. And so those words are something we want to preserve. So a lot of people ask, why don't we do the practices in English all the time? And that's the answer, because we need to preserve those words. Right now, that's our best connection to the blessings, direct connection. And so in the same way, the melodies, that was something Guru Rinpoche and Yeshe Sogyal showed to the disciples. In the same way, the tormas. Now, if you ask what a torma is, there's actually some of them up on the altar. They're basically, whenever you see these figures that are made out of dough or clay and they have little flowers on them, the different shapes. And a torma is basically a symbol that can be used for all kinds of things in our tradition. It symbolizes something, and then the practice tells you what it's actually symbolizing or standing for. And there's actually a quote about it. It's, you can say a torma represents four things, right? What are they? I always forget one or the other of them. Okay. So according to, here's, we have a scriptural quote coming from, I know she learned it. I know this, she learned it from, I saw it in the text. Anyway. So it's a deity, an offering, a weapon or nectar. Those are sort of the four official things that a torma can represent. But actually it ends up representing all kinds of things. So anyhow, Guru Rinpoche showed exactly how to make the tormas, what the shape should be, what they should look like for these particular practices. Each practice is different. So that's obviously, that's something we don't want to lose, is how to make the tormas, because it came from Guru Rinpoche himself. He showed exactly how to play the instruments, so how the horn is played for Dijam style practices, how the Kongling is played, how the conch is played. So there's this whole range of musical instruments, and he showed how to do these things. So as part of doing our practice in an authentic way, we want to try to have all of those instruments and try to play them as correctly as we can. So he showed all these things. So those are the things that we're trying our best to learn and trying our best to emulate and to do. And what it really comes down to is the actual text. If you look in the actual text for any one of these practices, like Heart Essence of the Dakini, or Heart Essence of the Lake-Born Vajra, or Vajrakalaya, or Vajrasattva, in the actual text it will say, for this practice, make the tormas like this, and put these things on the altar, and, you know, play the drums like this, and play the horns like this. And there's actual written instructions that come from the Tertön, the treasure revealer, or else from Guru Rinpoche, for each one of those things. So if we're trying to follow Guru Rinpoche's tradition, we need to try our best to follow all of those instructions as completely as we can. Which means that as a group, really, it should be everybody's goal. Everybody should be wondering, what does it really say in the text, you know, about how to make the tormas? What does it really say in the text about how to play the instruments? Are we doing that? Do we have that? Do we have the right tormas? Do we have all the instruments playing? Do we have all these different parts? Because as much of that as we can have, that makes our practice more and more authentic. That makes our connection to Guru Rinpoche stronger and stronger. And so that should really be our goal. And it seems difficult. These practices seem really difficult and complicated. There's so much to learn and so much to do and so many skills that you need to have. And but it's important to understand that they're not just difficult for us. They're difficult for the Tibetans, too. And they're even difficult for the High Lamas. And I saw this firsthand. I saw an example with Yongtong Tulku Rinpoche when he gave the Rinchen Terzut empowerments down at ODD back in 2010. So Yongtong Tulku Rinpoche was this great master from Tibet, a contemporary of our own Gyatso Rinpoche. And he came and he gave 2.5 months of empowerments from traditions that came from all over Tibet. It's called the Rinchen Terzut, which is a collection of all these different traditions that was made in the 1800s to preserve many, many different treasure traditions. And so he came and he gave those empowerments. So every day he was giving somewhere between 5 and 15 empowerments. And he, along with most very high lamas, is extremely traditional, and he believes in reading every single text and assembling every substance that's needed and giving the empowerment exactly as it says. And he holds himself to this standard. And in the empowerment text, there's a bunch of flipping back and forth that the lama has to do. It says, insert this prayer, and you have to go find the prayer in this other text. And you say that, and then you come back, and it says, insert this from the other thing, and you have to go there. So they're extremely demanding and complicated, but he believed in following the text exactly. And if he was following the text and it said, insert this prayer, and he couldn't find it, we would stop. One time we stopped for like 45 minutes while he and his attendant, Lama Norbu, were looking through all these texts trying to find the right prayer that needed to be said next. The whole thing came to a halt. We just sat there quietly and there was all this shuffling and shuffling. This, no, is it this? No. So he held himself to this high standard. And so at the time he gave these empowerments, he was 84. And I don't even know when he was getting up in the morning, but I know that he would get up and do his own practice up in his room for a long time, and then he would come downstairs. And so the staircase at ODD at that time, there was no chairlift or anything. It's just this really long kind of winding staircase from the upper floor to the lower floor. So he would come down that staircase in the morning time leaning on his attendant, and he would come into the shrine room at 6 a.m. every morning. And when he got there, he would be wheezing. You know, he's leaning on his attendant and wheezing. But he didn't just sit down. Everybody was like, oh, you know, he's old. You know, it's like you want to just pick him up or something. But he didn't just sit down. He would go over to the mandala. He would take off his zen, and he would do 3 prostrations to the mandala. So the mandala was our altar, and that was where we set up all the empowerment substances. And there were so many, it was like we had acres of real estate of empowerment substances set up there. This huge table, and like they were all around. And so the night before, we'd been setting them up. It was like Christmas Eve every time, because you would stay up late arranging all the presents for the next day, right? So we'd been setting up for every empowerment. There was whatever it says in the specific text that you need. So a boompa and a skull cup and a crystal and da-da-da-da-da, and put the long life arrow in the back and put this here and put that there. It said specifically in every single text. So you couldn't just do a standard setup. You had to follow each text. So Yantar Rinpoche, in the morning, he goes over and he's doing these 3 prostrations. And he's showing respect to our mandala. He's showing respect to the deities and to Guru Rinpoche's tradition. And he's showing respect to, you know, all of our gathered substances that represent all of that, the 3 roots. And I also had the feeling he was checking us. I had the feeling we were definitely, you know, things were being checked out to make sure everything was really okay. And because the night before, as we'd arrange everything, and then as a final touch, Lama Norbu would go and he would make sure every boompa was perfectly straight with the spout facing forward, and that every feather was straight, and that everything was just perfect, because that was the physical support into which the deity would be invoked. And so it was all, you know, the abode of the deity, the body of the deity, the blessings of the deity. So everything had to be just right. So then Yantar Rinpoche, he would do these 3 very slow prostrations in front. And then he would get back up and he would put his zen on. He's still wheezing. He would go and circumambulate the throne. So he didn't just sit down, but he went and circumambulated the throne, showing respect to the Dharma and the tradition and the blessings. And then he would get up on the throne, you know, stump, stump, stump up the steps, and then he would sit down, and then he would sit there for like 13 hours giving empowerments. He completely wore us all out. Everybody was getting sick. We were dropping over like flies, you know, people's in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and just we could not keep up with him. And he would just go on and on and on. And so in the morning from 6 until about 11:30, he would sit there and do the practice for every single empowerment. And again, he held himself to this. I mean, I always thought he was such a great lama, he could probably just generate the deity like that, no problem, right? But he would go through and do the practice for each empowerment he was giving, generate himself to the deity, generate the substances. And then around 11:30, he would take a little break. He might take a bathroom break. That's the only time I ever saw him get off the throne. And then he would have lunch. He would take a little, what looked like maybe a nap on the throne, just sitting there. And then at 1 o'clock, the people would come and we would start the empowerments. So then he would give empowerments from 1 o'clock until 5 or 6 or 7 or 7:30 or whenever he ended. And he was just completely tireless, and he just did the practices, and he believed in doing it all right. And you could tell it was this very authentic transmission. He didn't skip anything. He would just kind of plow through it all. And And then he would, after the impoundments were over, he would finish his practice. There's always a short concluding section where you finish the practice, do the dissolution. Then he would go up to his room and have dinner. And then he would say to his attendant, Lama Norbu, oh, bring me the text for tomorrow. I need to review all the texts and make sure that they're marked correctly. And this is the point where Lama Norbu would say, oh, no, no, Rinpoche, please, you just rest. I'll check the texts and make sure they're really marked right. So then Yantam Rinpoche would rest, and Lama Norbu would come downstairs, and it was Christmas Eve again. We would set everything up for the next day. And somewhere in there, Lama Norbu would mark all the texts so that Yantam Rinpoche had them. He was definitely not getting much sleep. So anyway, I just saw firsthand he cared about the details in the text because he knew that that is how we connect with Guru Rinpoche's blessings. And that's our direct connection, our direct conduit. And it was hard for him. I mean, imagine being 84 and just sitting there all day doing these practices. It's really hard work. But he was totally happy to do it. He was totally fine because of his amazing faith and devotion and realization and compassion. So that's just something I try to remember when these practices are challenging for me, when they seem like a lot of work or challenging, or I'm being asked to do something I'm really not good at, that kind of thing. Okay. Any thoughts, questions? Yes.
I have a question about did mostly the king come to Rinpoche? In other words, was most of the Dharma activity some way?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know very, very much. I think we have to keep reading all the books and try to figure out what they say about it, you know. Any other thoughts? Yes. Well, I think it depends. I mean, look at me. there's a difference. So Dharma clothing, the robes of the ordained are Dharma clothing. That's totally part of the Buddhist tradition. It is in the Tibetan style that was established when Buddhism came to Tibet, but still that's considered Dharma clothing. This kind of clothing that I'm wearing, or the robes of the Ngakpas, the white Zen or the white and red Zen, or those different things, those are also, they're part of the Buddhist tradition. I mean, they're sort of particular to Tibet, but they're still Dharma clothing, and there's specific teachings on how and when they can be worn. But then when you get into actual Tibetan, like chubas and that kind of thing, that is more of a cultural aspect. And that's where it just becomes what people want to do. It's perfectly, there's nothing wrong with wearing chubas. They're quite comfortable. It's also perfectly fine to wear Western clothing. So, but what is it, we always have to go back to, what does it say in the text? What things were specifically taught by different lamas in different ways? So that's how we tell the difference. So when we all sit down to do practice, there's different elements happening. Every practice has a body, speech, and mind aspect. So the mind aspect is the Vajra master. So you usually have a lama who's sitting at the head of the assembly, and they're holding that space. They're holding the meditation. Excuse me. Like during our yearly retreats, usually it's Lingchul Rinpoche. During our monthly soaks, Sangye Khandra and Lama Chanam hold that space. Also, it's fine for students to hold that space, such as Matthew or any of the older students who have been trained. Sometimes the Umze does it. But it's someone who is just holding the space of holding that meditation, and they also do certain things with the ritual. They have a certain job. The Chopin brings them certain things at certain times. So that's the mind aspect. And actually, everyone also is the mind aspect because we're all following along and bringing our intention to the practice. The speech aspect is the Onzet, who leads the chants, the chant leader. And his job is to sing the tunes correctly or chant correctly, doing the appropriate thing at the appropriate time, playing the cymbals, getting the prayers in the right order and according to tradition as he's learned. And then everyone follows with him with our own speech. And then the body aspect is the Chopin, or the ritual master. And so their job is to oversee the physical aspects of the practice, all of the offerings, how they're arranged, how they are made, what different activities happen at different times. So there's always this body, speech, and mind aspect. Sometimes here at Tashi Choling, if we don't have a lama, we just use the throne with Gyatso Rinpoche's picture on it. And he's also said that that was totally fine and appropriate. So we don't have to feel like there's something missing. And then, along with that, there's all of the other activities that are part of the torma, like all of the instrument players playing their instruments, like having the soak assembled, having these different offerings and things arranged. And so all of that is part of the treasure and part of the tradition. So when we come to do practice, like when we come to one of the four monthly soaks, or all of them, or when we come to the yearly retreats, there's personal reasons that we can come that benefit us, and then there's also reasons that have to do with the community and the world. So in terms of personal reasons, as it said in one of these quotes, Gyatso Rinpoche's quote, he was talking about how the soak ceremony. So when we do these practices, we generate the deity, we do generation stage practice, and then we also add on the soak practice, which is, people usually think of it as when we offer cookies. But it's a special practice that involves making a food offering and reciting certain things. And part of that is confession. And so the soak practice is especially good to help us purify and repair our own vows. So as Buddhists, we've all taken vows. And when you receive an empowerment, you take vows on all three levels: vows of refuge, vows of bodhicitta, and vows of secret mantra Vajrayana. And so after an empowerment, we have these vows. And the fact is that we are going to break them because they're very hard to keep. And this is normal. It's part of the tradition. We're going to break and repair our vows many, many times. And this is just how the practice works. And so, for example, when you take empowerment, the Lama introduces you to your nature as the deity. And he says, okay, you are Tara. And you're Tara for this reason and that reason and the other reason. And I'm showing you that you're Tara. And I'm blessing your body, speech, and mind to be Tara or whatever enlightened being. And you say, yes, I understand. I promise you, I won't forget that I'm Tara. And then we go out into the world and all hell breaks loose, right? But the fact is, we made that promise. And so how we train on the Vajrayana path is we keep coming back to that promise. So the soak practice is a way where we can confess, say, okay, I forgot I was Tara, but I know that the truth is I'm Tara and that my intention is to maintain that. And so first I'm just going to generate the correct view that I am Tara, that this is all Tara's pure land, that the soak substances are vast, bountiful offerings that are just manifestations of Tara's wisdom. And so first I'm going to generate that pure view, which makes the deities happy. They're like, finally, she's getting it. finally she remembered. Generate that, and then I'm going to confess all my negativity of body, speech, and mind, all my broken vows, and then I'm going to make all these offerings to please the deities and to restore my Samaya connection. And sort of in a nutshell, that's kind of the basic ideas of soak. There's a lot more information, and you should really get, you know, more serious teachings about it. But that's kind of the idea. And so gathering for soak one time a month or two times a month or four times a month, which is what we do here at Gyatso Rinpoche's instruction, that is a way that we purify and maintain those vows. And we definitely want to keep maintaining those vows as often as we can, because the more often you do it, the better they get. You're better at keeping the vows, your breakages become less, you accumulate a lot more merit, and so it's important that we basically do soak as much as we can. And so that's a personal reason. There's a lot of personal reasons why we do SOAK. We also come and we support each other. We practice in a group, which is productive of vast amount of merit compared to just practicing on your own. It's basically exponential when you gather as a group and you practice. And so that's another reason that we come to group gatherings. And then we can also relate. We can also help each other. We can also show each other things. We can also, you know, talk to each other before and after SOAK about our practice or just take care of each other. You know, we're a family. It's true. So those are personal reasons that it's good to come to SOAK and good to come to the yearly practices. There's also reasons that have to do with the community and the world and the temple and Gyatso Rinpoche and our connection to him. And so to think about those reasons, here's our temple, Tashi Choling, that was created by through Gyatso Rinpoche's kindness and through the kindness of many others, Sangye Khandro and Philip Thomas and Lama Yeshe and just many, many students have helped, have worked really hard over many, many years to build this place and to build it as authentically as possible and to create the statues, create all the different enlightened supports that we have, stupas. So we have this place. And we have the choice whether it's just going to be a museum of Tibetan art and tradition or whether it's going to be a living temple. And so what makes it a living temple is to have people come and actually practice. What Rinpoche has said is the temple is the container, it's the vessel, but the vessel actually needs to contain something. So what the temple contains is the practitioners. And what do the practitioners contain? We contain our Buddha natures, which is something really special. If you bring your Buddha nature here and it's contained in the temple, that's something very special and very precious, more precious than any diamond. And at the same time, we also contain our understanding, our faith, our understanding, our interest, and our compassion. So we are the vessels for our own wisdom, our own compassion, our own faith, our own understanding. And that's what gives this place meaning. That's what gives it an essence, if people are using it to practice. And so when we come here, we are making that choice to use Tashi Choling as a living temple and relate to it, not as a museum, but as a place that can bring us to the state of fully awakened Buddhahood. One thing Rinpoche said recently in one of the email teachings is he was talking about doing our practice and how this is our place. Like the Kolstein, this is our valley. Or Ashland, that's our city. And all the people there, those are our people. Those are our children, you know. And this country, this is our country. These are all our people. This is our world. So when you do practice, it benefits your world. And so we have to realize that all of this is our world and we can benefit it by doing our own practice. And that the Dharma is actually this very profound way to benefit the world. And Rinpoche has said that these statues, each one of the statues here, benefits not only the people who see it, but also everybody, not just the people in Ashland, but everyone in the whole country. So anybody who is concerned or horrified or worried or disturbed about the state of the country or the state of the world, this is a tangible way that we can benefit the whole country by coming and being part of Tashi Choling's living sangha and taking part in making this a real living place of Dharma that connects to Guru Rinpoche and his blessings by, through the power of our faith, through the power of our reaching out to the Buddhas. And so that's another reason why it's so beneficial and so amazing that we have the chance to come here and practice. Gyatso Rinpoche's original intention, his original aspiration that sort of drove him to America eventually was he wanted to light the lamp of Dharma in a dark land. And this is what has happened, come out of that. And it's our chance to keep that lamp going. Does anybody have any questions, thoughts?
Can you say when Rinpoche said that, he wanted to light the lamp of Dharma in a dark world?
It was one of the aspirations that he made I think when he went to Bodh Gaya for the first time. But I can check in my notes too. Yes. How are they selected? So I wasn't around, actually, when most of them were selected. Does anybody know exactly how they were selected?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
okay, yeah. So, okay, so basically we... Every month we do four practices. We do on Guru Rinpoche Day, which is the most sacred day of our tradition in a month. It's the 10th day of the lunar calendar. We do Soke Tuktik, which is Dujum Rinpoche's Guru Rinpoche practice. So maintaining this temple as a Dujum lineage temple, that is the practice that's done on Guru Rinpoche Day. Same with Dakini Day, the Khandra Tuktik. So maintaining this place as a Dujum lineage place, we should be doing the Khandra Tuktik on Dakini Day. So, because those are two of Dudjom Rinpoche's main practices, his guru practice and his Dakini practice. Then the other 2 days, we do Truma on New Moon, which is a really appropriate time to do a Dakini practice. And also we have, a lot of people have a very personal connection to Truma. And we do Amitabha practice on the full moon. And that Amitabha practice is Namchu Amitabha. And way back before the temple was built, when this land was first bought and Dharma was first being established here, His Holiness Pema Rinpoche came down to the Wang site and he had a throne right where the Vimalamitra statue is now. And the first big cycle of empowerments that were given on this land were the Namchu empowerments, which are treasures from Terton Migyur Dorje, who's another important treasure revealer. And so when we do the Namchu Amitabha on full moon, that is one of his treasures. So we are connecting with him. We are connecting with that lineage, which was the first thing propagated here at Tashi Choling. Amitabha is also the Buddha that you pray to when you pass away. He's very good at, very skilled at leading beings at the moment of death. And so that's another reason that we practice that. So for the 2 yearly retreats that are our Samaya retreats, in the springtime at Sagadala time, which is the time when around the holiday when, Buddha Shakyamuni achieved the state of fully awakened Buddhahood. So it's a very sacred month, the 4th month in the Tibetan calendar. So during that time, we do Vajrasattva practice. So the reason we do that is, for one thing, Gyatro Rinpoche has this very close connection to the deity Vajrasattva. And His Holiness Dujum Rinpoche took the text of this practice, Vajrasattva, and put it on Gyatro Rinpoche's head and said, "This is your practice. You and your students should maintain this." And so for that reason, we do Vajrasattva as the Lama practice for 10 days. That practice is also maintained as the Samaya practice for this temple. Ani Baba does it every day. And so that's like the bottom line. And it is Vajrasattva as the Lama, so the Guru as Vajrasattva. That's like the bottom line practice that maintains this temple as a living temple. And we also, of course, the first thing that was even built on this land was the Vajrasattva statue. So we just have this Vajrasattva energy and lineage and blessing that we're maintaining. For Vajrakalaya, Gyatro Rinpoche said that the Dalai Lama specifically told him to do Vajrakalaya practice, and that was really important. And so that's the reason that we establish Vajrakalaya in the fall. Vajrakalaya is also the wrathful aspect of Vajrasattva. And so it was really from the Dalai Lama's command, and Dudjom Rinpoche also agreed that it was very important. And so that's the reason we do Vajrakalaya in the fall. Ideally, we try to do it around the Phlabhap Duchen, the holiday when the Buddha descended from heaven, which is one of the 4 great festival days of the year, along with Sagadala and 2 others. But sometimes, if that's too late in the year, we do it earlier so that we don't run into too much weather. But does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. It would be nice to do a Tara practice, especially because we have the statues and everything, you know. I think that would be really lovely. Any other thoughts, questions, ideas, corrections? It's so the Nadran practice is the practice for guiding the consciousnesses of the deceased, and we have a tradition of doing that every year. Lingcho Rinpoche leading that and doing that during the Vajrasattva practice. And I'm not sure exactly when it started. Ever since I was involved, we were doing it, which is like 1999 at least. But now it's just become an every year tradition. So it's just one afternoon we do the ceremony that guides beings, guides their consciousnesses of the deceased to a better state. And it's kind of a complicated ceremony where their consciousness is summoned and purified and given food and sustenance and given dharma and given empowerment. And then poet is performed to transfer them to an enlightened state. So yeah, I'm not exactly sure when that started. We have to ask the historians. Was it around then? Maybe 1998. Mm-hmm. Relate to, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mhm. Mhm. Yeah. Also, I mean, I've done all this sort of focusing on why we do things in Tibetan and why we try to follow the tradition, but it's also equally important, or more important, to know the meaning, to be learning the meaning, and to read the English, and to try to learn about the meaning of the practices. It's really important to understand the meaning of what we do. And we do try to chant in English as much as we can, as much as time allows, to fit that in. And it's very good on your own to practice in English and Tibetan. The reason I emphasize the Tibetan so much is that it's easy for us as Americans. Of course, we want to read the English and understand and get into all that juicy meaning. And that's really good. But what we have to be really careful of is we're at this really tricky time, you know, when Tibetan Buddhism is threatened, has been threatened in Tibet. It's spreading all over the world. We're not quite sure. A lot of lineages have been lost. A lot of dialects of Tibetan have been lost. You know, a lot of traditions have been lost. We're not quite sure if this lineage is going to survive in an authentic way. And so that's why here at our temple, we try our best to learn Guru Rinpoche's exactly what he did. And that's why we emphasize the Tibetan. But it's equally important to know the meaning of what we're doing, to know the English, to read the English, to read books in English, to connect in English for ourselves as practitioners. So we're doing both. We are connecting to the English and to the meaning, but we're really trying to not lose the tradition. Maybe someday in the future we will have treasures that are written in English. That we could just do in English, you know. Maybe we'll get to the point where we have very blessed practices that we can just do in English and still be totally confident that we're completely connecting with Guru Rinpoche's blessings. But right now, we have to accept our karma of this particular time in history when the way that we can really authentically get the blessings is by preserving the Tibetan, by preserving the tormas, by preserving the instruments, by preserving everything. So we just have to work extra hard, basically. Help ourselves relate, help ourselves understand the meaning, and at the same time do the best we can to preserve the tradition for our own sake and for the sake of the world and for the sake of future generations. Yes. Mm-hmm. So this is a Nyingma Buddhist center. So basically within Tibetan Buddhism, there's four or five actually main schools. Nyingma, Sakya, Geluk, Kagyu, and Jonang. And so the Nyingma is called the old translation school. And so the Nyingma is what was established when Guru Rinpoche brought Buddhism to Tibet. And all of the enlightened translators like Barotsana translated the Dharma into Tibetan, and this whole tradition was set up. Then later, the King Long Dharma came, as I mentioned, and he tried to wipe out Buddhism in Tibet. And so after that, after he was assassinated and that whole, they got past that whole era, then the Sarma, or the new translation schools, started up. And so the other schools of Tibetan Buddhism slowly developed, and great masters came and they retranslated everything that had been lost, and those new lineages were created. So this is a Nyingma center, which means our lineage goes straight back to Guru Rinpoche and his treasures, and that's basically what we're relying on most of the time. Within the Nyingma, there are six main monasteries or lineages, and let me see if I can rattle them all off. They are Katok, Payo, Jechen, Dodrak, Minling, and Dzogchen. There we go. So the Katok actually appeared first, and then slowly the other ones developed. And a lot of times they're associated with certain treasure revealers, like the Namchu. Within the Namchu set of texts and teachings, there's really a lot, a large part of it is Mingyur Dorje's treasures. But Ratna Lingpa is also classified in there. The lineage that we are connected to is Minling. So Dzogchen Rinpoche's treasures are a subset of the Minling lineage. So our tormas are very close to Minling-style tormas. They're a little bit different because of Dzogchen Rinpoche's own exact instructions, but they're related to Minling. Our tunes are related to Minling. The things that we do are related to the Minling. Minling, M-I-N-L-I-N-G.
Would you say the six lineages?
Again?
Yeah.
Okay. Payo, Dzogchen, Jechen, Dodrak, Minling, and what?
Katok.
Don't ask me to say them backwards.
Actually, with the Sakya, they actually, their collab goes back to the
No. No.
Also within the Payo, I think from Karmachandra,
Yeah, yes, you're right. There's a lot of connection between the Nyingma and the Sarma, the old and the new schools, especially Nyingma and Kagyu, but also between them all. And the great masters of our time all respect all of those schools, have incredible respect for all of them, and take initiations from all of them. Gyatro Rinpoche himself, he has a connection to the Geluk. He took initiations of the Geluk lineage. He's taken initiations from all the different lineages. And so sometimes sectarianism can come up between the four schools, and our teachers have taught us that that's just completely crazy and has nothing to do with the true tradition. And a great example right here about not being sectarian is the Dalai Lama, who is a Gelugpa, told Gyatso Rinpoche, you need to do Vajrakalaya practice, which is generally a Nyingma-style practice. Vajrakalaya, that deity, is usually a Nyingma deity. And the Dalai Lama said, at my own monasteries, I do Vajrakalaya. My monks do Vajrakalaya, and you need to do Vajrakalaya. And so that right there is an example of the Dalai Lama himself, you know, recommending a Nyingma-style practice and a Nyingma-style deity.
And also the fifth Dalai Lama was a chairman of the practice of
It's all connected. Yeah. Any other questions, thoughts? Oh, so there's one other thing I'm going to share, since we have a couple minutes. When we come to the temple, we can think of it as a pilgrimage. We're going on pilgrimage to a holy place, just as if you were going to Bodh Gaya or Samye, because the temple itself has been blessed by so many very high lamas, and the statues are authentic, and they contain relics, relics of Buddhas, relics of great bodhisattvas. So this is truly a sacred and a blessed place. And every time we come, it's as if we were doing a pilgrimage. We have a living Bodhi tree there. So there are just so many things that make this into a sacred and a blessed place that we can come. And Lama Sonam Sering from Pema Osaling, he gave some advice about coming to practice and what kind of mindset to have. And so I'm going to read that. He said, "When coming to puja, it begins when you leave home. Cultivate a good motivation that you're going to do something that is not ordinary. In order to practice Dharma, what supportive conditions do we need? We must have patience, compassion, faith in the three jewels, pure view toward the Lama and our Dharma companions, and loving kindness towards all sentient beings. We must dedicate our practice to all sentient beings. If we have a good motivation, then whatever hardships we must undergo in order to make it to the Dharma Center, such as missing work or traveling a long distance, going to great expense, they are all meaningful. We are using our precious human rebirth well. Once you get here, when you come inside the temple, think that you've arrived in a pure land, and see it as the pure land of the deity you will be practicing. When you come in, do three prostrations to the enlightened representations, based on how your lamas have instructed you, while mentally emanating countless versions of yourself to prostrate. When you sit down, try to come early so you have a few minutes to sit and settle down, so that you're relaxed and ready when we begin. If others come in late and flustered, don't get annoyed. Just focus on your own self." So that's a way that we can even just use the coming to the temple as a practice. And it's important that we have to look at our motivation before we even leave home. We have to look at our motivation when we put it on the calendar that we're going to go, to have as positive and as vast an intention as we can, and to really recognize the preciousness of what we're doing. And then also, if you make mistakes, you just have to see it as an offering. Because what we're doing is we're stepping outside of our comfort zone, right? Like I said before, we have this great little comfort zone, this nice little bubble where the blessings of the Buddhas can't reach us because we're not trying and we're not having faith and we're not pushing and we're not having interest. So when you step outside of that, of course you're going to make mistakes. It's just natural. It's like it's a law. It's just a natural thing. When you come, you're going to make mistakes. Like, for example, you're going to ring your bell at the wrong time. You know, the chupan is going to offer tormas at the wrong time, or maybe even drop them, you know. The umze is going to play the symbols at the wrong time or do the wrong prayer or whatever. And this is just like a natural, normal part of our practice. And we're really just offering our egos up. You know, when you push and you try something and you make a mistake, it's this great offering of your ego, because you just have to be humble about it and you just have to admit. And so instead of seeing it as something bad, we should see it as like the best offering that we can make, is to try and to make a mistake. And Lingcha Rinpoche was saying one time, he said, you know, if you ring your bell at the wrong time, it's still an offering. You know, it's still an offering of this enlightened sound. It's still a perfectly wonderful offering. It's not, what's the big deal? It doesn't matter just because you did it when everybody else weren't doing it, you know. So it's good to, and it's also good to just, you just have to be light and have a sense of humor about these things. And if you watch the Tibetans, they all kind of play. For them, it's kind of a game. They're always kind of playing. And, you know, if the umze makes a mistake, everybody just kind of laughs at him quietly. You're not really supposed to laugh, though, so it's all sort of quiet. But, you know, everybody, if you make the mistake, it's just like the joke's on you, and then everybody just moves on. It's totally fine. So, and it's actually very good that Westerners are very earnest and trying so hard, because you don't want to just fool around either. You know, you want to be trying, you want to be earnest, you want to try hard. But then there's that aspect of letting go, or of just kind of enjoying the ego sacrifice that's happening. Yes. Basically, you just don't want to be pointing your bottom at any of the statues. So basically, if you make prostrations either facing this way or facing anything on the altar, then that's fine. I have heard Rinpoche say, like, if he was sitting on the throne and people were over on this side of the room, he didn't want them to turn like this and prostrate, because then your bottom is to all the statues. So he just wanted them to prostrate straight forward. But yeah, any of these are all enlightened supports. These are all, and they're all just different aspects of the same thing. All deities are just different representations or expressions of our own Buddha nature. So when we prostrate, if we recall that, and when you practice a deity, if you recall, this deity is inseparable from all deities, or you're prostrating, this Buddha is inseparable from all Buddhas. So it's not like you're giving up one Buddha to prostrate to another one, or it's not like you have to choose which one to prostrate to. You just have that faith and that understanding. And that's actually a really important point. When we do practice in order to purify our samaya, most of us have taken many empowerments. You know, we've taken empowerments for Tara and Vajrasattva and Vajrakalaya and Dorje Drolot and this and that and the other. And in each of those empowerments, we promised to see ourselves as that deity. When you took your Vajrakalaya empowerment, you said, I promise I will always see myself as Vajrakalaya. When you took Tara, you said, I promise I will see myself as Tara, and practice that. So how do we reconcile that? We can't do all the practices all the time. You can usually just do one practice. The way that we reconcile that is whatever deity you're practicing, you think to yourself, you know, this deity is the embodiment of all deities. The deities are not separate. So I'm coming here and I'm doing Guru Rinpoche practice. Actually, I'm practicing every deity I've ever received empowerment from. They're all this same nature. So by doing this one practice, I fulfill all of my commitments. It's really important to have that attitude and that understanding, because that's how we do fulfill all our commitments. If we think they're separate, then we're like, well, I did Guru Rinpoche practice, but I didn't do any Tara practice. Then all of a sudden you're not fulfilling Tara, because you think you're not, right? You think you're not doing Tara practice. But if you know in your heart the truth, which is that they are inseparable, then by doing the Guru Rinpoche practice, you're fulfilling your Tara Samaya, you're fulfilling your Vajrakalaya Samaya, you're fulfilling all of those. So that's a really important intention to have. And if you can remember it through the whole soak, of course, that's the best. But if you can't, you just try to remember it at the beginning. You know, you say, okay, I'm going to soak today to fulfill all of my commitments with all of my deities. So that's really important. Thank you. Yes. Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's my chance to learn, you know, and to study and try to get it right. And, you know, thanks to everybody for coming and participating. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard him say that Guru Rinpoche Day, and I've heard other teachings say that if you're just going to do one puja a month, Guru Rinpoche Day is the day, you know, the way to connect. But like I just said, all the deities are the same deity. So I think we just try our best, you know, whenever you can, whenever it works for your schedule and your energy and, you know, what you can do, you try to come to puja. Make some mistakes. Maybe it should just be your intention before you leave home. I'm going to go to puja and make some mistakes today. And then if you don't make any afterwards, you're like, darn it, I didn't make any mistakes. I guess I have to try harder next time. I think I would feel a lot more successful if that was my mindset. Okay.